And it's been one heck of a week. For those of you who have watched the Zimmerman trial, we're going to be getting together on Tuesday evenings at this hour, and we're calling it Trial Tuesday. It's been heartbreaking. It's been gut-wrenching. And it's been an eye-opener. My co-writer, she's my partner on this project, is Michelle Bostic. And I wanted to see the community. I wanted to talk to people in the neighborhood, people who knew of this case, who knew what was going on with this case, and who could orient me and answer some questions and tell me how the community felt. And that's what we had. We went to the community, and it was just touching. It was very, very, very touching. We got to meet women who have raised teenage boys, and we got to talk to several people who have suffered a loss. And more importantly, we got to meet, I would say, restaurateurs who took care of the Martin family. And it was very touching, very sweet. What happened was when one of the days last week when court broke out for lunch, Trevon's family went to eat at a local restaurant, and something very tender happened. The manager and the person who basically handled the case, was watching people come in, deciding, you know, where they're going to sit them, things of that nature, basically saw that it was that family, and they went into action. They didn't even speak. They just both knew what to do. It was very touching, very touching. It was heartbreaking, really. One of them made it a point to take care of isolating the staff and keeping them away from the family. And the other one, who was handling the preparation of the meals, watched that one of the men in the party was coming close to her at the counter, and she could see his tag, his family tag name, and as he gets closer, she sees that his name is Trevon. And you know, that's startling. And she looks up at his eyes, and he whispers to her, he says, "I'm Trevon's uncle. He was named after me." I mean, it's such a moving moment as she tells the story. It was very hard. Everybody had a knot in our throats because it's such a simple, sincere story. And they made it a point to take care of this family and be calm and quiet and give them a place of peace and privacy. It was just very sweet. In any case, Eric is here. Eric, welcome.
Hey, sorry about that. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much. And the case has been incredible, wouldn't you say?
It's been interesting. I think opening statements were different than what people expected. And I think so far they've been getting through witnesses rather quickly, probably a lot faster than people expected as well.
Well, this Judge Nelson, you know, plays no favorites, and she gets through things with tremendous efficiency. And if you say, "Oh yes, I gave you this document," boy, oh boy, she's going to look in her daytimer when you said you gave it to her, and if it's not there, she's going to assume it's a lie, and she'll put you through the ringer. So the attorneys are finding out that she is no joke.
No, she runs a very efficient courtroom. She runs a very professional courtroom. And she's a stickler for the rules of procedure on, you know, some of the credibility issues and some of the evidentiary issues with some of these witnesses.
Well, I haven't seen any of the witnesses get knocked down. I think they're all doing fine.
Not knocked down, but they're getting things out of each witness that at the end, I believe, I'm a firm believer that Mark O'Meara is going to do the closing, not Don West. And that Mark O'Meara is going to take a little bit from each of these witnesses that they've been getting out. Some of the key points, like today when we saw the female who was kind of the, took it on her own to coordinate the neighborhood watch, and said that she had recruited George Zimmerman to be in the Citizens on Patrol, force, and he refused. That kind of defeats and, you know, dejects the state's argument that George Zimmerman was a wannabe cop. Well, if you're a wannabe cop, the first thing you're going to do is when you have the opportunity to be in the Citizens on Patrol and kind of a pseudo law enforcement officer, you're going to grab that opportunity. And they got her to admit that he turned it down. Someone who wants to be a cop doesn't turn down an opportunity to act like a cop. And I think you're going to hear that in closing arguments. If I was making a closing argument, I would beat that home. You know, he wasn't targeting.
Yeah, and he didn't say at all that, in fact, he refused her.
Correct. He turned her down.
He refused
her. He said,
no,
thank you. Right. You know, and that's what I mean by they're able to get little things out of each witness that are going to be sewn together that they should be able to tie together and do what they need to do.
And as always, whenever we have an attorney present, we want you. You never know. You may come to Florida and need one, or you may come flying through here at 90 miles an hour and get pulled over, and then you really need a lawyer. Here's Eric Dubois, Esquire, Dubois Law Group, 390 North Orange Avenue, Suite 2300, Orlando, Florida. And to reach him, you dial 407-219-9577. Is that correct?
That's it. I appreciate it.
No, we will absolutely make sure that the public knows that you are providing commentary. Are you there during the day providing color commentary?
I've been there the past two mornings, early doing some local for one of the local news channels. We're kind of just playing it by ear to see what happens the day before to see what we need. But I've been out there and been kind of in the media entourage out there with all the media. And I would like to commend the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. They've handled it, and the court staff have handled the crowds and the traffic and the media remarkably well.
Not only would I like to commend the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, which absolutely has been superb, but I have to commend people that never see the light of day. They work indoors quietly. They're never heard from, they're never seen. And that primary person, the two people that I can think of immediately are Michelle Kennedy, who handles all the issues with the press, and I'd like to thank David Sirach, who handles all the technical issues with the press. They work, we get emails from them close to midnight, and we know that they're there at 6 a.m. When they sleep,
oh, yeah,
we have no idea. But the amount of work, the quiet work that they put in that's behind the public that no one sees, they really are what I call my unsung heroes. They work all the time. And they are quiet, unassuming, very humble, honorable people. I just can't believe the schedules they're keeping. This has been amazing.
Yeah.
Now, yesterday, which witnesses did you see that attracted your attention?
The 7-Eleven clerk to me was interesting.
Us. Why was he interesting? Because I found him interesting as well. Share it with us. Let us know why you think that. What about him?
To me, he had some credibility issues. He doesn't remember a lot of details, but he remembers certain things that are pertinent. To me, if I was a clerk at a 7-Eleven on a Sunday evening in February of 2011, or 2012, I'm sorry, and I, you know, it was a rainy day. I'm almost positive it was Super Bowl Sunday. You know, there wasn't much foot traffic through the 7-Eleven. And then, you know, the next day you hear that a young person was killed who had just come back from a 7-Eleven, but yet he doesn't remember any of that. To me, that was intriguing. It was also interesting as to what, you know, he testified his demeanor was, that he was acting normal, didn't seem to be out of the ordinary, acting any different than you would expect a normal person to be acting, which, you know, pokes holes in the defense that, you know, Trayvon Martin, I'm sure they're going to try and bring up, was acting out of the ordinary that night, was, you know, not a normal 16 or 17-year-old child. But it also bolsters the state's case that he was just a normal kid out getting some Skittles and a soda, and this is what happened.
Well, you know, if we're going to talk normal, then throw it all on the table, let's talk normal. Let's talk about that. I think you're absolutely right, and it looks important to me. I was thinking this. If I were going to look at the situation as to who was acting normal and who wasn't, I can't ignore the fact that once George went into, you know, when he was taken into custody many months later, one of the first things that he required while he was there was his medication. And when you look at the prescriptions, or maybe someone mentioned it, I don't remember now, but it wasn't as though he just started taking these prescriptions now. Apparently he'd been on them quite some time, and one of them was Adderall and the other one was Temazepam. Now, both of those are controlled substances that you can't buy over the counter, and they're not dispensed by doctors, physical, internal internists, or regular general practitioners, but instead they are dispensed by psychiatrists. So I wanted to know, first of all, why are they continuing? Why isn't there an interference with, if a person is on that serious a medication, which is a narcotic and a controlled substance, why are they allowed to have a concealed weapons permit?
Oh, I mean, that's a bigger issue. I think that's one that's being debated in the nation right now with gun control and gun regulation and mental health evaluations. But, you know, Adderall, for someone who's prescribed Adderall and is supposed to be taking Adderall, doesn't necessarily affect their ability to make rational decisions. I know a lot of lawyers who go into court every day and argue and represent people in criminal actions and civil actions who are prescribed Adderall. A lot of it's for, you know, their ability to focus.
Yes,
so
ADHD, you're absolutely right.
Right.
The ability to focus, that's right.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
It doesn't necessarily.
Well, what about the Temazepam for manic depression? What about that? He was taking Temazepam for manic depression.
Do you think people
are able to function acutely and with accuracy on Temazepam as well?
If it's regulated and you're taking the regulated dose and you're under the observation of a doctor, that's what the drugs are for. I mean, to allow you to function in a normal, non-manic state of mind. That's why people prescribe the drugs. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the next time you're at the supermarket, you know, three or four people in that are on those drugs. And, you know, we don't know until something like this unfortunately happens as to whether or not that was a triggering effect. You know, when these drugs are administered properly and they're taken properly as prescribed, they function as someone who wasn't on those drugs and didn't need to be on those drugs. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be an issue. I think it may come into question if and when George Zimmerman testifies and whether or not his mental state is at question. But the state's going to have a huge burden to show without talk screens or anything that he was overdosing or was going outside of his normal prescribed limits, because I think, especially with a jury panel of six six females, five of which I believe have children. They're going to understand.
Yes,
you know,
five
nowadays,
of them have children. Correct. Five of them have children.
I mean, nowadays doctors hand out ADHD, diagnoses of children, like we hand out candy on Halloween. I mean, it's an easy cure-all. Oh yeah, they're hyper. They can't focus. Give them some Adderall or Ritalin, and just let's get on with our lives. And I think parents are going to relate. Okay, so he took the drugs and he was normal. Big deal. Let's move on. Potentially.
Wow. Well, the next thing I noticed was that they brought in a series of police officers that had been at the scene.
Right.
Did you notice that?
Well, they've got with the state, I think the state is doing a very good job in setting up chronologically what happened that night. You know, they started with the 7-Eleven clerks, then they called in the 911 operator, then they called in the person who organized the neighborhood watch. Now they're calling the first responders and the officers who arrived at the scene. They have to establish what they found. What did the scene look like? Because, you know, we can't recreate it. You know, I don't know if the jury is going to make a field trip out to the apartment or the condo complex at that same time of day, you know, to kind of replicate what the lighting situation was. But these officers are the only people that can testify as to what they saw. I mean, George Zimmerman's under no obligation to take the stand. So besides the officers, besides George Zimmerman, there's no real witnesses. You know, people heard things from their rooms and their houses. But no one can testify as to what they saw, what position Trayvon Martin's body was in, what was around him, where was there any blood? If there was blood, where was it? How much was there? What was the condition of the grass?
Well, it was raining that night. Do you think the rain washed it away?
I think there's a potential that the rain could have washed some of it away. What the defense was saying today was that, you know, Trayvon Martin was armed with his deadly weapon was the concrete, the sidewalk. And I believe what the officer testified to was that if you look at the foot positioning of Trayvon Martin, that could support the argument that he was possibly straddling someone who was on the ground and hitting their head. Now, the problem is in the pictures where Trayvon Martin's body was found,
yes,
it wasn't a sidewalk.
I know. I saw that.
It wasn't found on the sidewalk. So how do you explain that? But, you know, from the defense perspective, okay, even if he wasn't found on the sidewalk.
Could the body have been moved? Could someone have moved the body?
Well, someone could have moved the body. He could have, you know, George Zimmerman, when he got up, could have flipped him over or pushed him away to get out of the scene. I mean, obviously, he had to get out. If we're to believe George Zimmerman's story, he had to move Trayvon. He had to get out from under Trayvon Martin, which would mean the body would have to be moved a little bit after the gunshot was fired. Do I think he positioned the body to make it? No. I think that would have taken way too much effort, and there would have been evidence, and there would have been, you know, blood, you know, moving here and there. But I think, you know, with the rain, it could have washed blood away. But the bottom line is, you know, from the defense perspective, what they're going to argue is even if his body wasn't found on the concrete, the wounds to the back of George Zimmerman's head were not self-inflicted wounds.
Okay. Anyway, what I was going to tell you was I wanted to talk about the head wounds. I saw the head wounds. I have pictures of the head wounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that the blood is running the wrong way. If you are laying on the ground and you're horizontal, the blood should be going from your head downwards. Therefore, when you get up, the streaks of blood should be going from the front of your head to your ears, you know, backwards. In other words, from your ears on backwards to the back of your head. Instead, the blood streaks on his head are running from the top of his head going south, which means he had to be vertical. You can't be both. He has no, and by the way, that blood was dry. And he has no dry blood that's going backwards. All the blood streaks are going downward, as though he too is vertical. And that is a problem that I'm having with the direction the blood was going. Why is it going downwards?
I would not be surprised if there's going to be an expert that testifies that that is what happens when he was laying on the ground. And that, you know, the blood dried and it was just, that's just the way that the cookie crumbled, so to speak. But I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm looking.
It went ahead and it dried, and then after it dried, that then he bled some more. Could that be a possibility?
Potentially, weren't the pictures taken at the
scene?
The pictures were taken. Weren't some? I thought some of them were taken at the police station.
I thought at the scene by the car. She said today she took pictures of the back of his head, the side of his head, at the scene. She took pictures at the police station, but at the scene is when she took those pictures.
Yeah, because I'm online right now looking at him, and the blood's running from, it looks like it's running from the middle of his head down to his ears and down to his neck, the ones that are at the scene, and the ones at the police station, or you can see where it's kind of dried up a little bit, the blood running east-west, and you can see the fresh blood dripping north-south. You know, to me, the blood dripping east-west, you know, if you're laying down on the concrete and your head is pushed against the concrete, the blood's going to go the path of least resistance, which is going to be east-west as opposed to running straight down. And I believe that's what you're going to hear the defense say, is that that's consistent with your head being hit. You know, but the bottom line is, where did those wounds come from? And there's been a lot of argument about, you know, George Zimmerman getting out of the car. You know, and something that people...
That's the biggest problem. And another thing that we found out while we were here the other night is that it's not a crime not to listen. I mean, it's not absolute. You don't have to absolutely listen to a 911 dispatcher. They are lay people. They are not deputized by the sheriff or the police. They are not police officers. Unless when they answer, they say, this is officer so-and-so. That's different. But otherwise, you don't have to follow their instruction. And today they said something very interesting, that they have liability issues. In other words, they don't want to get sued. So they don't want to give orders. They want to make suggestions. Tell me about that. Do you know anything about that? That was new to me.
Well, they're not deputized. They're not law enforcement officers. They're, like you said, they're lay personnel, and they can't give direct commands because they don't really know what is going on. I mean, they can suggest, hey, you know, I hear gunshots outside. Well, I would suggest that you don't go outside. You know, if you go outside, you're doing that on your own. But part of what has really gone undiscussed and untalked about with this is just because he got out of the car doesn't necessarily make him, quote unquote, the aggressor. He could have gotten out of the car and said, hey, what are you doing here? And then if Trayvon Martin attacked him or swung at him or did something, then Trayvon Martin now becomes the aggressor because George Zimmerman technically wasn't doing anything that was hostile. He was inquiring, what are you doing here? And we don't know. I'm speculating.
We're speculating, we could guess anything, of course.
Right. But this is the problem in a case like this where, unfortunately, you have an individual who's passed away, who was killed, and you have a defendant who's under no obligation to testify, but you can create all these theories, and all you need is a couple of jurors to say, you know what, that could possibly have been what happened, and that creates doubt. And that creates a sense of, well, we don't know. Maybe that is what happened. Maybe, you know, George Zimmerman walked up to Trayvon Martin and said, hey, kid, what are you doing here? What's going on? Why are you here? And, you know, we heard testimony, I believe it was a testimony today, that when Trayvon Martin was on the phone, someone heard him turn around and go up to George Zimmerman. Well, why would that's inconsistent with what Trayvon Martin's alleged girlfriend or whatever she was said, that she heard George Zimmerman approaching him and starting, and that they were talking. And this person said they heard Trayvon approach George. And if that's true, the only person that really knows what happened is George Zimmerman.
Yes.
And if that person says, well, I heard Trayvon go approach George, well, the burden then kind of shifted, you know, or not the burden, but the who was the aggressor may have shifted from George Zimmerman to Trayvon Martin. And honestly, that's all George Zimmerman needs. Is one
that's
juror saying, that's reasonable doubt.
Yes, it is. Now, my next question. The way things are going, there will be an outcome. One side will not be happy.
Correct.
What do you think will happen if Trayvon's situation is seen as, like you said, the aggressor, and George Zimmerman is acquitted? What do you think will happen?
I don't want to even speculate as to what possibly could happen.
We have to speculate. It's important. We have to speculate.
My hope is that this will bring about some changes to the law, some changes to the stranger ground law, some changes to gun control, gun laws in the country.
Yes.
The one thing that I think has been evident from the beginning, and that from Trayvon Martin's family, from his parents, from Benjamin Crump,
yes,
their attorney, is the call for peace, the call for faith in the judicial system, in the faith.
Oh my gosh, that was such a loving thing that they did. I was so impressed. What a beautiful thing to do. The man which they called peace.
Yeah, they've been a total class act from the beginning. And my hope is that when it comes down to closing arguments and the jury is sent back to deliberate, I believe you're going to see a call for that again from them. I believe you're going to see some of the community leaders in Sanford, in Seminole County, not only in Seminole County, in Orange County, in the surrounding counties in Central Florida, come together and unite and say, you know, we all live in a free democracy. We all live in the United States of America with a constitution where everyone is entitled to their day in court. Everyone's presumed innocent until proven guilty. We've put our faith in the judicial system. We've asked for a day in court. The evidence was presented, and a jury of six people are going to render a verdict, and we have to live with that verdict. I mean, look, it's been 2 years since the Casey Anthony trial in Orange County. And
do you remember that? How everybody was so upset?
Everyone was so upset, and 24 hours later, we got on with our lives, and we moved on.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And there weren't riots. There were peaceful protests. There are people, obviously, who were upset. But at the end of the day, we moved on, and we put our faith in the judicial system. And that, you know, we've got tens of thousands of men and women around the world defending our freedoms, and that's what we have to just stick with that. And whatever the outcome is, you know, it's a tragedy. And whatever the outcome is, someone's family is not going to be happy. Trayvon Martin's, George Zimmerman's, and no one knows. My hope for the community, as someone who lives here, is that it doesn't turn into, the L.A. riots after the Rodney King incident and all that, something like of that nature, because I would like to think that we're better than that here in Central Florida, and that we've grown up as a nation since those days, and we can move forward.
Well, I have to take a moment to send out a greeting to Mr. Richard Barrows and Miss Patricia Barrows, husband and wife from Merritt Island, Florida. these lovely people are, well, they're people that I love very much. They're my in-laws, and they're listening tonight. And I wanted to say hello and greetings, and I also want to say to give greetings to my friends in California. I see that you're online, and I know that you come to the show to listen. And I want to say, give greetings. In fact, if we're going to take a moment and say, give good greetings to the countries that are listening right now. We're Jamaica is joining us, so I'm just going to just read the countries that are here right now. Jamaica, Germany, Osaka, Japan, Tokyo, Berlin, and Stuttgart, Germany, Naples, Italy, Haifa, Israel, Chicago, Illinois, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Toledo, Ohio, Germany again, Zimbabwe. Welcome, Zimbabwe, but you've been here before. Yes, they listen to us in Zimbabwe. It's amazing. Chicago, Illinois, all of you in Florida, I could wave from you from my window. California, Chino, Los Angeles, Oakfield, Redfield, Stockton, Toledo, Ohio, Wisconsin, Uruguay, Venezuela, Arecibo, Puerto Rico, welcome. And I'm not going to keep reading the list because it's too long. I'm glad to say, I'm very proud to say that we are an international radio broadcast, and we are going to again mention Eric Dubois. Eric, very slowly give out your website. Spell it slowly, and your phone number. In case any of you visit Disney World and you want to take a vacation and you start speeding and they pull you over and you get arrested, you need an attorney, Eric Dubois is available. Eric, give us your number again.
Sure. The phone number here locally is 407-219-9577, and the web address is www.dubois.com. Dubois, that's D as in David, U, B as in boy, O, I, S as in Sam, law, LAW, group, GROUP.com, and we're here to serve and happy to talk to you and help you out in any way we can.
That's excellent.
And I would just like to say I'm very impressed with the people calling in from Chicago, because if my team just won the Stanley Cup, I'd be out partying still.
Well, some of them are not into sports. Some of them want to listen to sports and then run to the internet and get onto syndicated news radio. Absolutely.
Very good.
And we want to also welcome Cebu City. Cebu City, Philippines, is always so faithful. I did a study with them out at Columbia University. And they've listened to me for years, and I'm very grateful that you're still with us. And my students at Columbia University, I know you're out doing other things, and I'm very proud to have taught you. I've never forgotten you. I keep all of your pictures, as well as my students at Brevard Community College in Brevard County, Florida. I have your pictures, your class calendar. I've never forgotten any one of you. In fact, whenever I see one of you, I know you by name immediately. It's wonderful to run into you. And this weekend, we wanted to get into an example of what the Black community was thinking and what their thoughts were. And we actually went to Sanford again, went to a local restaurant, and then after that, and we spoke to people that were working there, and that's the restaurant I opened the show with. I was telling you about that. I'm going to play that. It's only a few minutes long, but I 15 minutes, and I want you to hear it, because in there I also have the question and answer that I had with Robert Zimmerman, where he didn't. It's the denial that's in there as well. and some other thoughts that I had about this case, and I've recorded them. And I then went to a soul food restaurant, a real, I mean, genuine soul food, no joke. This is a serious, serious soul food restaurant. And my gosh, what a lesson. Because I got to sit with the community and listen to what they felt was important. And it was very impressive. The restaurant's name is From Scratch, and I visited them, and they are located at 1641 North US 1, Cocoa, Florida, and their number is 321-806-3912. And we went to have some soul food to sit with the community and see what they really think, not what they say, but what they think in their hearts. And it was impressive what people thought and what they shared with us. And I'm going to play it for you now. It's only about 12, 13 minutes. And, of course, the accompanying music is by none other than our CEO, John McEwen, who was one of the founders of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So if you hear good music on our show, that's the reason. All of our music is written by or produced by or property of John McEwen, and he has licensed it to Syndicated News. And in any case, here we go. Listen carefully. Here we are. Well, I went ahead and cut that music short, but I want to identify it. That music was written by John McEwen, one of the founders of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and John McEwen is our CEO here at Syndicated News. So if you hear a lot of his music and a lot of his musical themes, it's because he has licensed his music to Syndicated News. And by the way, John McEwen is the person who taught Steve Martin how to play the banjo. That's correct. Steve Martin didn't just appear one day playing the banjo. It was John McEwen who taught him how to play the banjo. We want you to know that. In any case, do join us. We're here at 347-539-5024. That's 347-539-5024. And we're taking calls and we're taking emails. We have some questions here from Chicago, Illinois, again. Oh, no, it's Springfield, Illinois. The question is about the body. They were, from what the public has read, this family wants to know, it's a family in Springfield, they are saying that everything they read about this case stated, and George Zimmerman stated profusely, that Trevon was banging his head against the concrete, banging against the concrete. The pictures I saw today, his body was nowhere near the concrete. So how did his body get from where he was with Zimmerman, banging his head into the concrete, to the center of the grass part of that yard? What explanation might you have? Do you have any explanation at all? Mechanical engineering type of explanation, physics. What do you think, Eric?
I think what you're going to hear from the defense is that Trayvon Martin was beating George Zimmerman's head against the ground, and then George Zimmerman was able to overpower him and get up, and then Trayvon Martin landed a couple punches in the face and knocked him down again and was continuing to punch him in the nose, and that's when he fired the fatal shot.
So let's see. Here we are. There you are.
Sorry about that.
It can't be helped. It can't be helped. It could be wind. It could be lightning. It could be anything. Yes, 719, would you like to join us?
Oh, wow. So you have direct access to the courtroom.
Yes, we're in the courtroom every day.
I'm curious of what you guys think the relationship this trial may have, or perhaps compare and contrast to the Rodney King trial in terms of the racial impact?
It's just amazing. We're going to add a line. Let's see how we do it. Here we go. There we go. Eric, can you hear us?
Can hear you now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
We have a question. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, should I repeat my question there?
Please do. It's a very good question. Please repeat it.
I was interested in what you all thought about the relationship. I suppose some sort of compare and contrast between this trial and the Rodney King trial.
The similarities, the comparison and contrast between this and Rodney King, I hate that race is being made a big factor in this case. I mean, you have...
But it is a factor in the case, Eric.
It certainly is a factor. You cannot deny that.
It's a factor. There's no doubt about it. Was George Zimmerman racially profiling Trayvon Martin? No one knows. I mean, George Zimmerman is the only person that can acknowledge that, and admitted that.
Well, I was thinking I suppose a national level. The impact it could have in terms of race relationships between people in the United States, perhaps globally even, because I'm sure we all know the repercussions of the Rodney King trial, how it led to the LA riots and things like that. You know,
I'm worried.
Do you understand what I'm asking here?
No, I get it, but I think the bigger, you know, that was a situation where you had a large number of white law enforcement officers pummeling an African American male in the middle of a gas station on a traffic stop. That basically set off a riot throughout the country as to, you know, law enforcement, white law enforcement officers.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
racially,
I understand what happened.
Profiling
the LA riots and all
this
that.
Right, and in this case, what initially happened was you had people protesting in Seminole County and in Sanford because the police didn't do anything.
Uh-huh.
And in their minds, had the roles been reversed, had an African-American male killed a white child, he would have been incarcerated that night. I think what this case is going to do for at a national level is probably raise awareness and, you know, that there's still some, you know, racial profiling that potentially happens outside of law enforcement. We've gone to a society where, you know, everyone carries a firearm.
Our Second Amendment, but perhaps you're not hearing me exactly what I'm trying to ask of you. I'm saying in a hypothetical scenario where George Zimmerman is acquitted and found not guilty on all charges, do you think this may have a similar outcome to the LA riots where the police? No, there's no chance of that?
Is there a chance? Yeah. You ask me, do I think it's going to have a similar reaction? My answer is no. I don't think it's going to elevate to the scale of a Rodney King. I think you're going to see some protests. I think you're going to see some issues in Sanford if that happens. I don't think it's going to do that.
Honestly.
Where do you live?
Well, I live in New York, but I have a lot of family down south there. Actually, pretty close to that area.
I mean, I don't get the sense in the community. I was in Sanford today for hearings.
Uh-huh.
You don't see the protests. You don't see the people picketing or standing outside the courthouse that one would expect. I think,
trial, and we have to understand what we're dealing with here. I'm saying, this is one of those, they say, trial of the century. I mean, perhaps it's not that big of a deal, but nevertheless, this is a, you know, a widely publicized trial. And what I'm trying to express to you in comparing it to the Rodney King trial is that I think if George Zimmerman is acquitted...
Well, first of all, I want to let you know that I understand this is a professional show with possibly millions of viewers, so the uses of obscene language, I did not I prepared myself not to be using any obscene language just because of the nature of the show and how it's being broadcast.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Thank you so much. Please proceed with your question.
I was just wondering, as you may have seen from my Skype account name, it ends in the three digits, 420. It is the symbol for the marijuana community. And I just wanted to ask if the fact that Trayvon Martin was smoking some marijuana is going to affect him in the trial or is going to help Zimmerman in any way?
The judge has ruled on this issue that unless for some reason the state brings it up and the state brings his character and Trayvon Martin's character in issue, that it's inadmissible evidence because it has no relevance at this time.
His smoking pot has no relevance to this case.
But inadmissible evidence means that the jury hears it, but then the jury is told that they shouldn't take it into account when making their decision or ever hear.
No, Rob, listen to Eric.
If either attorney, first of all, the judge has had a hearing on it, and the judge has ruled that neither party can bring it up. If the state brings it up, the defense, could arguably.
In any case, I wanted to say, Eric, give us your phone number again in case anyone's flying their car through Orlando, perhaps, or somewhere in Florida, and they need an attorney right away. Give us your number again, please.
Sure, it's area code 407-219-9577.
Excellent. And I wanted to ask, be patient. I can't get to all the calls all at once. Eric, tell us about today. What went on today? Tell us about that while I go talk to
11 dispatchers. Remarks were to George Zimmerman, and when the first responders rolled up on the scene, what the forensics showed, what where Trayvon Martin's body was, getting into evidence, his clothing, how his body was positioned, talking about the coroner, talking about what they found when they went to the coroner's office to examine the body, what they found with regards to scrapes and bruising, the condition of George Zimmerman. When they arrived on the scene, what his demeanor was, what his facial, what his bruising remark, marks look like. I think what you're going to see for the next couple of days is a lot of the police, law enforcement, first responders, some of the people in the community testifying as to what they saw and heard, that led up to the eventual shooting. I would be very surprised if we get into a lot of the forensics and a lot of the expert testimony as to proximity of gunshots and all that before, Friday. To my knowledge, I haven't heard the judge make any determinations as to whether or not court will be held on Saturday and as to whether or not there's been any decision with the upcoming July 4th holiday, how the court's going to handle it. The July 5th and July 6th, that weekend afterwards. But I think you also saw today the defense attorneys, whether it be Mark O'Mara or Don West, who are both very skilled defense attorneys, get some evidence out of and testimony out of the state's witnesses that you're going to see them weave into a nice web that shows some reasonable doubt in their mind as to why George Zimmerman should be found not guilty. And that they're going to be able to use during their closing. And I think what you're trying to get out of each witness right now, if you're the defense attorney, is one little nugget, one little piece of information that it's part of your puzzle. And you're as a defense attorney, you're putting together that puzzle to create that reasonable doubt. And you heard today, part of the state's contention all along has been that George Zimmerman is a wannabe cop. And that was part of their opening. And that's been part of their theme is that this was sort of vigilante justice
and that he was always a wannabe cop, which is why he was caught carrying a semi-automatic firearm with one in the chamber and a fully loaded magazine. But you heard their own witness say that George Zimmerman turned them down when requesting, when he was asked to join the Citizens on Patrol command of the police department, and also was very complimentary and to the officers and to the people in the sheriff's office with regards to the Neighborhood Watch program. And I think what you're going to hear, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks on closing argument is that here's this person that the state wants you, the jury, to believe was out seeking vigilante justice and was a rogue individual who wanted to be a law enforcement officer, but when given the opportunity, turned it down. And that's a huge blow to the state's case, because that takes away some of his preconceived notions and his predisposition to behave this way. That's pretty much what I've got so far out of today. And, you know, we've got a long way to go in this trial. We've probably got another two and a half weeks of testimony from both the state and the defense. And there's going to be a lot more that comes out. There's a lot that we know that the jury will never know. And that's the luxuries and the joys of a jury trial, is only admissible evidence is what they need to base their rulings on, not a lot of this superfluous hearsay and speculation that people make.
I actually was telling my father-in-law and my mother-in-law, Pat, my father-in-law Richard and my mother-in-law Pat, that actually I consider her my mother. I call her my mother. She's my mother in my head. And I was talking to them about it and saying just that. I said to them, I actually can't tell you what I've learned about this case until this is all over. I have to wait, and then we'll sit down and we'll talk brass tacks and we'll talk about the details. But it's heartbreaking what we know and what we can actually discuss and what we can't. There's more that we can't talk about than there is that we can talk about. So every day, as more material comes out in that day's course, event, then we're free to talk about that. And one thing that I want to be free to talk about is the fact that George said he had me by the head, and that was the weapon he used. He banged my head against the concrete. And I know how to count, and I know how to look at feet, and I saw how tall this kid was. You know, he's like a string bean, long and lanky, and I don't see how he got from concrete all the way to the middle. There's no grass anywhere where his body is, and that concerns me a lot. That concerns me a lot, because the only way he could have gotten way over there would be if he had been flung. Like when you put someone, your knee or your foot on someone's chest and you fling them, you know, and you toss them over, if that had happened. But by then there were enough people watching that fight, and nobody said he kicked him and he flew up in the air and he flung him. No one said anything like that. And I'm discussing it today, and I didn't discuss it last week because it came up in court today, so I feel free to discuss it. Eric, what do you say about that?
I think, you know, this is why I think George Zimmerman is going to have to take the stand, because there's no one else that can explain how the altercation happened. And, you know, I have no clue as to what George Zimmerman would testify to, but my guess is you're going to hear something to the effect of that he was, Trayvon Martin was on top of him. He was getting his head beat in against the concrete. George Zimmerman was able to overpower him and stand up. And then Trayvon Martin jumped on him again and started hitting him in the nose and knocked him down. And that's when, you know, George Zimmerman fired the fatal shot, and it was in the grass. But that he was hitting his head against the concrete. Grass isn't going to do create those scratches and those cause you to draw blood from the back of your head. Typically, if your head's getting beat into grass, it's you know, even though it's Florida, it's still a dirt base. It's not a rocky base.
And just being the devil's advocate, I mean, what should have stopped him from banging himself in the nose and scratching his own head?
Those are not self-inflicted. I mean, I don't think...
They didn't even need one stitch Again, I'm being the devil's advocate.
Correct.
But when he went to have medical care, they looked at his scratches. They were not cuts. They were scratches. Now, remember the skull. The head is very visceral. When you bleed from the tiniest scratch on your head, you're going to bleed like a stuffed pig because that's just the nature of all the veins going up to the head.
Yes.
So, a little scratch on the head is very bloody. But they wouldn't even put one stitch in, not one stitch. Doesn't that tell you something? Just being the devil's advocate here, as my son would say, just saying.
Not necessarily, because it's, you know, the standard for stand your ground is, do you have a reasonable fear that you're going to suffer, you know, severe or great bodily harm? And in the state of Florida, severe or great bodily harm is a draw of blood. Doesn't matter how deep the wound is, how big the wound is, how many sutures are required to heal the wound. And someone pummeling you in the face, you don't know what's going to happen, which goes to George Zimmerman's state of mind. There's no law enforcement officer. There's no 9/11 dispatcher. There's no medical expert that can testify as to what George Zimmerman's state of mind was in February of 2012 when that altercation happened, except for George Zimmerman. And if it's George Zimmerman's testimony, it's going to be that he was afraid for his safety and he didn't know what Trayvon Martin was capable of doing when this happened, that's pretty much all the defense needs. And I would be shocked if the defense doesn't have some experts that are going to say, you know, when you look at the wounds on the back of his head, they're consistent with, you know, scrapes from concrete, and this is how, you know, we conducted a study, and this is how concrete with its rocky base and rocky core, most concrete isn't perfectly flat. There's some roughness to it to help with traction and water, that these scratches are consistent with someone's head or, you know, an abrasion being created by concrete. We all know, we've all ridden a bicycle and fallen off and gotten a raspberry or a scrape on our knee from hitting the deck on a concrete driveway or sidewalk or something. And I would be shocked if the defense doesn't have some sort of expert that's going to say these scratches are consistent. You know, when you clean up his wounds with hydrogen peroxide or something, and you can get down to a close-up of what the actual laceration looks like, I'm sure it's going to be very similar to that we expect to see when you fall off a bike and you scrape your knee or scrape your leg, those kind of liney-type scratches. And like you said, you know, when you the slightest little cut on your head will bleed and, you know, may not require stitches, but eventually it'll clot and eventually it'll stop and eventually it'll heal. But just because you didn't require stitches doesn't mean that about to suffer great bodily harm or had a reasonable fear that you were about to. And that's the standard in Florida.
And another thing I wanted to mention was, as that caller had mentioned, that he's from the 420 Society or whatever, and is it going to come out, is it going to be discussed that Trayvon liked, that he smokes weed, and was that going to be an issue? And as you explained, it wouldn't be. But I also have to say, if they're going to discuss Trayvon smoking, then they have to discuss the fact that George Zimmerman takes Adderall and Temazepam, and he was on it that night. He said so. He absolutely said so. In fact, when he was eventually arrested, they had to bring that in. That was on the list of items to bring to him, and he was on the phone asking his wife for the medication and identifying what it was for. If I have to dig that up and play it tomorrow, I will, but these tapes are public, this in Florida. Oh, by the way, Eric, explain to the public, because we have listeners from all over the world right now. And excuse me for on my Google Bubbles and my Yahoo, we're actually at capacity. So forgive us for that. But Eric, explain to the public what Florida's sunshine law is and how it works. And by the way, I also threw in the chat room, I threw in a link to the photographs of this trial. The way they're positioned, the photographs you first see are the ones taken today. They're fresh today. The ones before that were the day before, and the day before, and so on. It goes all the way back that way.
Yeah. Florida
Sunshine Law. Tell us what the Florida Sunshine Law is.
Sure. Florida Sunshine Law is that all public meetings or all public events that involve a government agency or someone acting on behalf of a government agency are to be held in the sunshine, be open to the public and open for people to attend, to watch. They have to be notifications of. Court proceedings are open. There are very few court proceedings that are typically closed. So these trials are all public. Which is why here locally in Central Florida, the local news media stations are running gavel-to-gavel coverage of the trial, and everything is public. There's TV cameras in the courtroom. More of an issue is Florida's public records laws, where...
Tell us about those.
Yeah, the public record laws are where any person in the public, anything that's filed in court, any person in the public has access to those records. And those records are to be made available to the public so we can see exactly what the evidence was and what documentation is filed. Certain things can be redacted from those documents. Certain things can be redacted to protect bank accounts, personal private information. Some medical records can be redacted. But typically in a case like this, in a criminal case, once the state files a motion or once the defense files a motion, those documents become part of the record in our evidence. And at the close of the trial, typically the evidence that's presented become part of the court file, become part of the record, and it would be available to be viewed and to be scrutinized by the media and by the public, which is why, in high-profile cases like this, you get media usually filing public records requests and requesting that, all the documents be provided to them, usually within 48 hours of being provided to the other side, so certain items can be redacted. Witness names, which is why a lot of these witnesses, we just knew them as witness numbers. We didn't know names or addresses to protect their privacy during the pretrial publicity in the months leading up to this trial. With regards to the jurors, that's purely up to the judge whether or not she wants to release those names. She's made a determination that she's not going to release those names immediately. She may never release the names, and it can be up to the jury to come public and make their identities known. But Florida has very broad public records laws and very broad open meeting, open court proceeding laws to make sure that the citizens of the state know that everything's being done on the up and up and that, people are doing their job and following the laws.
And also, Eric, if you could for a moment explain what the Stand Your Ground law is, because that doesn't exist in all states, just a few. Explain what that is, because a lot of people still ask me, what is Stand Your Ground? What's that all about?
Sure. Stand Your Ground in Florida is where if an individual believes that they are, has reasonable belief that they are in fear of suffering great bodily harm or severe bodily harm or potentially death, that they have the right to defend themselves with equal or deadly force depending on the situation. Typically in a stand your ground, there's what's called a stand your ground immunity, which the defendant has the opportunity to have a mini trial before the trial starts where they can present their evidence to show, judge, this shouldn't even go to trial. This is stand your ground. This was a situation where the defendant acted the way he did or she did because of X, Y, and Z, and then present your evidence to show that. In this case, the defense team made a tactical decision not to apply for that immunity, not to ask the court to have the stand your ground immunity hearing, but it doesn't waive their ability to raise the stand your ground defense or raise some sort of self-defense in their case in chief and during their closing arguments. But basically it goes, stand your ground goes to the defendant's, the reasonableness of the defendant's actions and the reasonableness of the defendant's state of mind. were, did they have reason to believe that they were going to be the victim of a great or severe bodily harm? And that's what this case is going to hinge on, is whether or not George Zimmerman at that time felt that the actions he took were the only reasonable actions and the only actions that he could take to defend himself. And that was he in fear for his safety?
And if we want to talk about suggestive looks and things of that nature, the front page of this episode here at Block Talk Radio, we have several pictures. Of course, we have the Syndicated News logo. And the next picture is a picture of Eric Dubois. Then there's a picture of another attorney. There's a picture of Trayvon. And the most unusual picture is a picture of George Zimmerman Sr., and the photographer was sitting on the opposite side of Trayvon's mother and father, and you can see that they're sitting on the right of Attorney Crump, and George Zimmerman Sr. glances at Trayvon's mother and father, and the look he gives them, it's amazing that photographer captured that moment. It's a photo that will be standing in for me, truly. And it's part of the photos, the long photo listing that I gave you of the Flickr account for Syndicated News. I also gave you the program for syndicatednews.net, where we have a live stream, and syndicatednews.net is going gavel to gavel. We attended all the hearings, and we are attending all of the trial and appeals should they happen, but we are going minute by minute. And Eric, I think, do you have a cold?
A little bit.
Anyway, what I did was, this is a wonderful thing, I picked your call up through Skype, and
yep.
I piggybacked it on this call, and you sound clear, and it hasn't dropped you again, so maybe that's how we'll do the show. We'll just pick up your line, and that works fine. And does anyone else have any questions? We're asking, does anyone else have any questions? We've got plenty of time. If not for the moment, Eric, give us your phone number again, please.
Sure. The office phone number is 407-219-9577.
Keep that number. What do you do? Criminal defense?
Criminal defense and family law.
And family law. Need a divorce? You're in Florida? Things didn't work out? You go to Disney World? Wife or husband doesn't behave? Don't even wait till you get home. Divorce them while you're here. Go to Disney World on their nickel and divorce them. Get a good lawyer. Eric Dubois is right here. Give us that number again, Eric.
Sure. It's 407-219-9577.
And one of the unusual things that's going on, of course, not just the racial divide, but we've got that situation where we are looking at what we think is acceptable speech and what we think is not. For instance, in the middle of this trial, as that caller said, we're talking about the issues of the racial divide. And when I went into the black community this weekend, again, they spoke about the racial divide. And then we have Paula Deen. We can't ignore that. She speaks, as I was told today, like a true Southerner, and that's exactly how it was told to me several times. She's a Southerner, and so that somehow explains it. And she explains to the New York Times, I think it was, how her grandfather suffered because they took all his people, and all his people were gone, and no one could really run the plantation. And she was lamenting how awful it was for her grandfather, or her great-grandfather, I actually don't remember because I didn't give that part attention, but I had never heard a white Southerner lament the fact that they had lost their slaves, and how she explained it from a business perspective. And it was interesting because this morning, yesterday, she didn't show up at, I think it was Good Morning America or the Today Show. The Today Show, I don't remember which one, but she didn't show up. And she was supposed to show up today. I don't know. But she sent in her two sons. And one thing we should learn as parents, do not send the boy to do a man's job. It's never effective. And she sent the two boys in to defend her, and the broadcaster is reading from her sworn testimony under oath. And the boys both said, oh, that's a lie. That's an absolute lie. That she never said that. And now they just said the absolute opposite of what their mother swore to in testimony in a deposition. Now, what happens in that case? Her sons have absolutely denied what she said under oath. Who are we going to believe now, the sons or the mother who swore under oath the exact opposite to what the boys said today about Paula being a bigot or not? What do you say, Eric?
The only person who can testify as to what was really said is Paula, and you've got the transcript. So, you know, obviously...
They were reading from the transcript. Now, will the transcript be valid now that her two sons have invalidated or called her a liar? Because they both can't be telling the truth. Either the sons are lying or the mother's lying. Which is it?
Well, I mean, if and when, that ever, is in front of a jury or a court or whatever, and she's asked about that, it's going to be her deposition. She gave that under, penalty of perjury. She was sworn to tell the truth. And, she's going to have to stick by those words, and that's it. I mean, the sons obviously, are biased. They're out to protect their mom. And any attorney that has made it through their second year of law school is going to be able to, show bias and elicit that kind of testimony from the children of Paul Dean. I don't see that carrying any weight at all.
None whatsoever.
The damage is done. No. Mm-mm.
None at all.
Not from the kid. Not from the sons. I mean, her words are going to come back to haunt her. That's she said it under oath in the deposition. That's you're under oath. Are you lying then or are you lying now?
Which one is it? Because her sons went on national TV today to deny that their mother had ever said those things when their mother swore in a deposition. Will she be called back in and told, your sons just said the exact opposite?
No.
She won't be? Okay, great.
I don't think so.
What a horrible time. She's lost two big sponsors. And actually, I don't feel bad, and I'll tell you why. Because for 3 or 4 years, while she knew she was a diabetic and she stopped eating butter and sugar and I don't know what else, she kept feeding it to America. In fact, when Oprah Winfrey asked her, is this okay? She said, I'll never forget it. Paula Deen said to Oprah, honey, I'm your cook. I'm not your doctor. And I was thinking, what a clever, flip thing to say. And, of course, here she was, already diagnosed as diabetic, and there she was, feeding that sugar and those sweets and that fat and butter and I don't know what else to the country, to the world, while she herself was going on a diabetic diet. How hypocritical is that? So I don't feel bad. She's made plenty of money.
It's hypocritical, but at the same time, we're all, we've got to take responsibility for our own decisions. We all know smoking is bad. Smoking causes cancer. Cigarette companies are still making cigarettes, but it's a choice that people make with all the science that's out there and all the studies that are out there to still light up and to still smoke. We've got to be responsible for our own decisions, in which I think, if she tells you, she makes these, she goes on show cooking and using these ingredients, it's your choice whether or not you want to do it. It's kind of like, what's going on in the George Zimmerman trial and what we see in criminal trials all the time. You've got to be responsible for your actions. You're an adult, if you're in these situations, and you've got to know right from wrong. You've got to know how to, make a decision that, is best for you. Don't, you can't just take someone else's word for it. I mean, if we all did that, we'd all, you know, who knows what we'd all be doing.
And I want to say, I think it's time that they make a decision nationwide. If you are on meant, if you're suffering from depression, if you're a manic depressive and you are on controlled substance medication like temazepam and many others, I don't think you should carry a gun. I don't care about the HIPAA laws. I don't care about your civil liberties. I don't care. If you don't have it together in that area, I don't think you should be carrying a gun. I just don't think it's fair. And then we're concerned about a 17-year-old and weed. We should be more concerned with an adult of 28 or 29 years who's on temazepam and what's the other one? Adderall for ADHD, who has a concealed weapons permit. And I'm looking at that and studying that when I find that his wife also carries a concealed weapons permit. And they're so cocky that they feel it's acceptable. I'll repeat it again. To stand there, and the judge specifically said, Bernard Deliaranda, the prosecutor, asked, do you have money that you can access? I don't think so. Do you have money in any account? Not that I know of, when they knew perfectly well that they had plenty of money. They had plenty of cash. Actually, in one account alone, they had $121,000. And they were moving that money back and forth. In fact, this week we will play all of those tapes where they discuss moving money back and forth and where they discuss how now people are really behind you. And we need the public to hear that, because a lot of the public didn't hear those tapes. And it's good for them to hear that. It's important. And we have them all. We have all of the tapes, and we will play them. And I wanted to say that if you're going to be on any type of controlled medication, there has to be a national decision on whether or not that individual can carry a concealed weapon. I do not want to find out that a person that's got a gun on him also has a controlled substance because he or she is a manic depressive. I will be very angry if I find out that that person waving a gun at me just left the psychiatric hospital because they were going to their weekly visit. That will really annoy the heck out of me. That's really an insult, because there are millions more, like myself, who do not carry a weapon, and we're not on any type of medication, and our brains are fine, and our minds are fine, and our behavior is fine. Yet the person who has demonstrated to have a temper or is manic depressive is able to get a concealed weapons permit. I don't agree. What do you say, Eric?
It's above my pay grade. I'm not going to – I mean, this is an issue that I would rather stay out of, to be honest with you right now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm just – you know,
you heard it, Eric. Oh, my God. Gosh. Well, I will have to get that question answered, because that's so important. I can't thank you enough. I realize there are so many of you, and I thank you for joining us this evening. We have gone beyond our expected time, and we are going to say goodnight, and I can't thank you enough. We're going to play that tape, and Eric has got to get ready he's got to get ready to be in on the court grounds tomorrow morning, don't you?
Yep, that's my plan.
And I have to be ready because I leave my home at 6 a.m. to be in the court by 8 or before then. And we'll be in the media room as always. And if you'd like to send an email, send it to news at syndicatednews.com. syndicatednews.net. That's news at syndicatednews.net. And we will absolutely listen in, and we will start our tape again. For those of you who missed it, we're playing it again for you. And here it is. And we'll, with this, we'll, Eric and I will be saying good night. And here you go.
Jessica and Gwen work together at a local Sanford, Florida eatery. But these two hardworking women noticed Trayvon Martin's family had dropped in for a meal. And the two of them collaborated to make sure Trayvon Martin's family ate in peace, without interruption from any member of the staff. And they even took whatever steps were necessary to bring as little attention to the family, if any at all. Jessica discreetly made sure that the employees didn't approach the family. And it's very moving to listen to her as she tells the story. She remembers wanting to keep the atmosphere as calm and as quiet as she could. Gwen made sure that their order was precisely as they requested.
We're here at a local eatery in Sanford, Florida, and we're talking to Gwen McKinney, who has lived in Sanford, Florida for 48 years. Gwen, thank you for taking a moment to talk with us here at Syndicated News.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Gwen, we were wondering, you've lived here 48 years, you've seen this case, the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman murder trial.
Mm-hmm.
They finally agreed on a jury. They have no blacks on that jury.
I don't think it's fair. They could have, like, had half and half, you know, half black and white, or, you know, Hispanic. But just to have all whites, I think it's not fair.
Yeah.
I would like for Zimmerman to be able to do some time. I ain't saying he got to do a lot of time, but he needs to do some time for the crime that he has committed.
She remembers one man in the family's party as he approached her counter to place his order. She couldn't help but notice that his name tag read Trayvon. She read his name and glanced up at him, and he quietly whispered, "I'm Trayvon's uncle. Trayvon was named after me." In a day and age when most people are trying to get into the action and get a moment of attention, these two co-workers were kind and quiet as they cared for a family that had suffered a very painful loss, the loss of a child. These two women went above and beyond the normal customer service model. They showed absolute and effective compassion and shared their moment with syndicatednews.net exclusively.
Yeah, I just felt like they came in for lunch, not a press conference, that they got away from the courthouse for their 30 minutes apiece, and the employees, some of the customers wanted to interact, but I just made sure that on my part, my employees just kept working and allowed them to have a peaceful lunch and not have to think about it.
We're here at From Scratch Cafe. It's a soul food cafe in Cocoa, Florida. And we ran into
Stephen Tennyson.
Stephen Tennyson is a former military gentleman who's now working right here in the neighborhood.
I work for Mainstream Engineering.
And we're asking him what his opinion is on the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman murder trial. Give us your opinion.
My opinion is that I think had Mr. Zimmerman mind his business, i.e., listen to dispatch, stand down like they asked him to do, that young man would be alive today.
He said, I think that if George Zimmerman had listened to the dispatcher and stayed in the car, Trayvon would be alive today. Sanford, Florida is pretty much a typical Florida town. Where it differs is that the average resident is slightly older than most towns of comparable size. Homeowners run 3-1 against renters, and the typical Seminole County juror is generally white, a business person, and a tax-paying Republican. Case averages show that 90% of felony defendants lose in Seminole County. But this won't apply to George Zimmerman because having a Hispanic on the jury made it possible to get around calling this jury an all-white jury. in spite of the Supreme Court ban against conveying all white juries, they are still commonplace here in the state of Florida. How such a throwback to the 40s and 50s still exists anywhere in this country is surprising, and it's exactly where the nation should begin its conversation about the justice system and its racial divide. Mark O'Mara leads the Zimmerman legal team, and he has steadily fought this 25-to-life reality that George is facing. But they've brought in Don West, and Don West is helping O'Mara shoulder this battle. West is a shoot-from-the-hip lawyer, best remembered for getting Crazy Joe Spaziano off death row. Spaziano was a motorcycle gang member convicted of raping and murdering an Orlando teen whose body was later found in an Altamont Springs dump site. What's more memorable about that case was that the witness against Spaziano remembered the case after being subjected to hypnosis. The case soon unraveled. But just this week, Don West wanted to make sure that Judge Deborah Nelson would prohibit the prosecutor in the Zimmerman case, Della Rionda, from using the words profiled, vigilante, wannabe cop, and several other words and phrases. He also wanted to prohibit the prosecution from mentioning that Zimmerman had confronted Martin. O'Mara and West tried to prohibit the expression wannabe cop as well. The expression wannabe cop, however, is not a put-down expression, but actually descriptive of George when you consider he's tendered job applications to work as a peace officer in the states of Virginia and Florida, but has never really been offered a position as a peace officer in either of those two states or anywhere else. Judge Nelson said that the expression wannabe cop will be allowed in court as it's the basis of the state's case. Last year, when this case was developing, several news agencies, perhaps competing for ratings, edited the 911 tapes and aired the doctored versions where the question by the dispatcher was removed to make it sound as though George was a racist, even if he wasn't. I spoke to Robert Zimmerman Jr., his brother, on Sunday, June 9th, by phone. It wasn't the first time he and I had spoken. We'd spoken in the past when we've run into each other in the hallways during hearings. I had asked him on June 9th if he agreed that his tweets, actually I called them Twitters at the time, I asked him if he thought his tweets were racist in nature, and he actually agreed. He said he knew that they were off, and I said, do you agree that they're inappropriate? He said, yes. And we continued. We had a fairly normal, cordial conversation by phone, and I sent him an email, which included that question, because he asked me to write down the questions and email them to him so he could run them by his attorney. I did that. He read my questions and answered me, so he can't say he doesn't know what I'm talking about. And that question is in the list of questions I sent him. On Monday, June 10th, he caught us all by surprise by staging an impromptu press conference. I asked him again if he thought those tweets were racist in nature and reminded him that he had agreed that they were incendiary just a day earlier. And here's my question and his response.
I asked you yesterday, and I'm asking again, do you find that during the trial when you let out your own Twitters that are, as we discussed and agreed, racist in nature, aren't you fueling the fire?
Well, I did not discuss nor agree to that.
I also pointed out that he was eloquent. The entire family appeared to be particularly well-educated, and his father was a retired magistrate judge. I asked him what possessed Shelley and his brother to lie to a judge directly, stating that they had no money when they all knew very well they had plenty of money.
Robert, as intelligent as you are and eloquent, and as well-educated as your family is, your father being a magistrate judge, what possessed Shelley and your brother to go ahead and tell a judge, we have no money, we have nothing? What possessed you when you knew you had funds?
First of all, I disagree with that they somehow collaboratively told that to the judge. Second of all, because Shelley's facing charges, I don't comment on that right now.
It was about $121,000 in one account alone, I remember. And we all even heard recordings of Shelley and George discussing this while he was in jail.
which has always led me to the idea that they're very naive and immature to expect any modicum of privacy while one of them is in jail, is incarcerated. And again, he kind of denied the denial by saying that he can't go ahead and answer that question because Shelley's facing a perjury charge. Someone was screaming, help.
911, do you need police, fire, medical?
Maybe both. I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
Okay, what's the address that they're near? And is it a male or a female?
It sounds like a male.
And you don't know why?
I don't know why. I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, ah.
Okay. Does he look hurt? You?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right. What is your number?
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
This one.
And then we hear a gunshot. We've got to recognize that this is not George Zimmerman's first rodeo. George's lawyers are very sharp, and they love throwing little remarks out there. One of them that they say regularly is that George has never had a felony conviction. But even that's kind of a fancy play on words. You've got to consider that in 2005, his ex-fiance filed an injunction against him. She claimed that he smacked her with an open hand, and he filed an injunction against her as well, claiming that she was the aggressor. In 2007, George had a physical altercation with an undercover ATF officer at a bar near the University of Central Florida. His friend, who was a bartender at the time, was suspected for and was being arrested for serving alcohol to minors. George objected, not realizing the men were ATF officers. He felt that they had to identify themselves to him. They felt they didn't have to identify themselves to him at all, since he had nothing to do with the incident. Well, the incident resulted in a shoving match. Now, George escaped having a felony formally applied to his record because he was offered and he accepted what is known as in some communities a diversionary program. You can't ignore the reality that he had to complete the program in order to avoid the felony charge. That's how it didn't wind up on his record. It doesn't mean he didn't commit a crime. It means that he escaped having the felony record stay on the record if he complied with the diversionary program. Not surprisingly, injunctions were filed to seal the outcomes of both cases. So wanting to learn what the black community in general thinks of George Zimmerman, we went directly to the genuine soul food restaurant known as From Scratch Cafe. It's located at 1641 North US 1 in Cocoa, Florida. It's owned by David Williams, and there we met several people and asked them their opinions. In general, everyone felt that if George had listened to the dispatcher's instructions and stayed in the car and not followed Trayvon, that the teen would be alive today and that the senseless death would not have happened at all. Many people think that when a dispatcher, a 911 operator, gives them an instruction, they have to follow it because they have the idea that since they're at the police station, or so most people envision, that they are police, and whatever they tell you to do, you must. In actuality, they're lay people. They're not deputized by the sheriff. You don't have to listen to the 911 operator at all. So that's just one more point to clarify.
My name is Stephen Tennyson. I'm on syndicatednews.net.